This is an oral history interview conducted with Jack Arnold Druckmiller by Robert Tidwell on the 8th of August at 2003 at approximately 9 o'clock in the morning Central Time. Mr. Druckmiller.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning. How are you today, sir?
Fine, thank you.
Just to begin, what kind of childhood did you have, and where did you grow up?
I was born and raised in the little town of Marion, Indiana. The population was about, 50,000. And I grew up in that town under what I would consider to be average conditions. I had an average childhood. By average, I mean normal childhood. I had no outstanding successes as a child. I attended grade school, elementary school, and high school in that city.
And from what you said, the population was about 50,000, so it wasn't a small town by any means, but it wasn't a large city.
No, right.
And what sort of things did you do as a child? Did you have any jobs when you were younger?
While I was in high school, I had a few odd jobs to help provide some spending money. I delivered groceries at that time. Small grocery stores offered delivery service. I worked as a theater usher and other odd jobs like that to make a little spending money.
You don't see very many people offer grocery delivery anymore, and I haven't seen a theater usher in a long time.
That's for sure. Times have changed.
So you would say that your family's condition was average, a little above normal, a little below normal?
I think I came from a family of average means. My father was a hardworking man. My father was a wholesale candy distributor, if you can imagine, and he distributed candy to small grocery, drug stores, and places of that nature, where they would purchase candy by the box. For example, a Milky Way in those days cost, a nickel. I can remember he sold a box of 24 Milky Ways for 78 cents. And he made a living doing that kind of work for many years.
Okay. So what kind of education did you have before you entered the Navy?
Upon graduation from high school, which was in 1940, I hadn't determined exactly what I wanted to do, and I suggested to my father that I was going to maybe work for a while, and he changed my mind rather quickly then and said, "No, you're not. You're going to school now." He didn't want me to get out of the habit of studying. So in the fall of 1940, I entered a small college in my hometown. It was called Marion College. It's now called Indiana Wesleyan University and has grown considerably. I entered that school and started on a general administrative type course. Not yet knowing what I wanted to do. But as I approached my second year in that school, I decided that I thought that engineering would be a field in which I might be able to succeed, and I transferred from Marion College at that time to Purdue University and started on a course leading to a degree in electrical engineering, which I eventually attained.
Okay. And what led you into electrical engineering?
I don't know. I really don't know. I just liked electrical gadgets, and of course electronics was starting to be an important part of our lives then, and I think that's probably why I lead that way.
Okay. And do you still work as an electrical engineer? Or
I don't work now. I'm retired. I've been retired since 1987, but I spent 40 years in the electrical business with American Electric Power Company. 40 straight years. I had no other job.
That's unheard of these days as well.
Yes, indeed.
Were they an electrical power provider, or did they manufacture equipment? Or?
American Electric Power is the largest generator of power in the United States at the present time, and incidentally owns the company where you are now speaking from, Lubbock, Texas.
Okay.
American Electric Power started in central Indiana. That's where the original company got its start, and became a large generator and distributor of power to many, many customers, and has grown over the years. The company later on even got in the nuclear business, and I was involved in a portion of that. I spent the first 17 or 18 years with the company in sales, involving sales to industrial accounts, commercial accounts, large commercial accounts, and places like that, where in those days the power company provided people, employees, who would go out and assist in recommending how electricity might be better used in their industry or business to make them more money. And that was the general idea of sales, of electrical sales at that time. We helped with engineering problems that they might have. Later on, I was changed to a different portion of the part of the company. In 1972, I was asked to move to the company's new nuclear plant in Bridgman, Michigan. And I was surprised when they asked me to do that, but because I had no background in nuclear power generation at all. But the vice president of the company who invited me to go there suggested that they wanted me to be there as a public affairs representative for the company. I did that for 3 years, and in fulfilling that obligation, I discovered that one of the problems the company was going to meet or going to encounter was that of the environment, and its impact on the environment, because people were concerned at that time about how nuclear energy was going to affect the environment, and we even had people on the shore of Lake Michigan where the plant was built who thought that the plant was going to heat the water in Lake Michigan so warm that they would cook the fish. So we had a real problem in trying to explain to people how nuclear power plants work and how safe they can be, and I spent 3 years of my life doing that. Then, after that started, the environmental concerns started, the company decided that we had other places in the company's service area where environmental problems were a concern to people. So I was moved to the company's headquarters here in Fort Wayne, where I now live, and we established an environmental department to deal with those kind of problems, air, water, pollution, byproducts, and so forth. And I spent the last portion of my career with the company as a manager of that organization here in Fort Wayne.
Boy, that's an incredible resume there.
Well, I didn't mean to be so long, but I guess
no, no problem. Did you get married before or after your time in the service?
I was married after I got out of the service.
Okay.
I wasn't married until I was an older guy, and I don't know. I was interested in marriage when I first went into the service, but because of me going one way and my wife to be, or girlfriend to be, a girlfriend at that time going another way, we parted company and went our separate lives from there on. So I didn't marry until after I had gotten out of service.
Okay. Where did you meet your wife?
I met my wife in my hometown of Marion, believe it or not. She was over there visiting some people. She was from Muncie, Indiana, and she was over there visiting people at the time in Marion, and I just casually met her, and it all started that way.
And Did you go on to have children?
Had two children. Had a daughter who is now deceased, and a son, and the son is still, son lives here in the same city I live in. He's 42 years old, never been married.
Did he follow in your footsteps and go into electrical engineering?
No, he didn't. He's in a different line. He's in the landscaping business.
Okay. Yeah, that is a little bit different.
Quite a bit. Quite a change.
So what was your age when you decided to go into the Navy?
I was age 20. I enlisted in the Navy at Purdue after I had transferred over there from the Marine College that I originally talked about. The draft was getting pretty prominent, and all of us faced the fact that we were going to have to probably serve the country. And I took advantage of a program. We had our choice at school. The Army was there. The Navy was there. Everybody was there to enlist people and get them into branches of the service. I chose the Navy, and I enlisted on December the 14th, 1942, as an apprentice seaman in the United States Naval Reserve for 4 years. That was my original agreement.
Okay. And in your questionnaire, you had indicated that you had entered into something called the V-12 program.
Yes, at that time, the Navy had programs for people that they wanted to prepare to become officers. They had a program called V-5, which was for people who were interested in naval aviation, and V-12 for the rest of us. And I was placed in the V-12 program, or went on active duty in the V-12 program, as a matter of fact, after my original enlistment, at Purdue. They had a unit there, and all I had to do was move down the street about five blocks from where I lived to the dormitory, which was at that time taken over by the Navy. And I spent the next two semesters. I had four semesters of college at Marion. Then I spent the next two semesters, I spent two semesters at Purdue before going into the V-12 program. Then after I was placed in the V-12 program, I spent two more semesters at Purdue. Had a total of eight semesters of college, but no degree at that time. And that's all it took to qualify you to go to one of the midshipmen schools. And I was sent to the United States Naval Reserve Midshipmen School at Columbia University in New York. I often think about the movie that I can't remember the name of it, where the guy who was going to become an ensign in the Navy got off the subway and went down the street to the school. That's just exactly what I did. I was sent to Columbia University, and I spent the next 3.5 months there in a program that was casually referred to in the Navy as the 90-Day Wonder Program. I was commissioned an ensign in New York City. Believe it or not, at St. John the Divine Church, which, by the way, is still under construction, never has been completed. It's so large. And after being commissioned in that church, our class was all separated and sent different ways. And my first assignment was I was commissioned in June of 1944. My first assignment was to go to the Small Craft Training Center in Miami, Florida. And I thought, gee, how lucky can you be? So I started my active duty career at that point.
Okay. And what prompted you to join the Navy? Did you have some friends who had said, oh, join the Navy, I did? Or did you have some relatives who had been in the Navy?
I had a good friend, a very close friend. We lived in the same fraternity, and we both went down at the same time to sign up for the service. We knew that we were going to have to serve. And I said, you know, I kind of like the looks of the Navy program. It just seems to me that it has a lot to offer. And his choice was the other way. He thought he would prefer to serve in the Army. So we parted company at that point. He went one way and I went another. We've all talked about that. It was a matter of selection.
Okay. So what did you do at the Small Craft Training Center?
Well, the Small Craft Training Center was a place in Miami, Florida. We lived in the Columbus Hotel expenses on how to serve on small craft. They had a lot of sub chasers, they had a lot of minesweepers, they had a lot of other small craft used in the Navy at that time, and I thought that after going through that school and going through that training that I would be assigned to a ship of that type. But in the interim, they decided to send me to the Fleet Sonar School at Key West, Florida for 5 weeks, where I trained to become an anti-submarine warfare officer. In other words, that's the guy that has charge of the group of people on the ship who normally are in the anti-submarine warfare business. That was hot and heavy in the Atlantic at that particular time. Lots of German submarines, and they taught us how sonar works and how, well, they taught us how to attack submarines. And that was my next assignment. Came back to Miami after that, thinking that I was going to be sent to a ship that had anti-submarine warfare equipment, which the Evans did, and I was sent to Norfolk, Virginia, and it was announced to me at that time that I was being sent there to assist in the formation of the crew for the USS Frankie Evans.
Fantastic. Did your transition into sonar school, was that based upon your experience as studying for an electrical engineering degree, do you think?
Not exactly. You know, I've never really given much thought as to how they chose people to go to sonar school, but I had a little bit of a musical background. I had what I guess you'd call a pretty good ear for music, and sonar operation requires a very finely tuned ear to listen to the equipment and determine what's happening. So that may have been my entry into the sonar business or the anti-submarine warfare business. I don't know. Had really little or nothing to do with electrical engineering because the sonar equipment was maintained by a different group of people on the ship, as it was in all cases. I mean, they have a regular electronics group that takes care of, maintains those kind of equipment, and so I don't think it was really my degree at that time. And as a matter of fact, I had not completed the work for my degree. I didn't have the degree at that time. All I had was 8 semesters of college, and 2 of the semesters I took at Marion College did not count toward the degree because they were just courses that didn't apply. So I had to anticipate getting my degree after I was released from the service, or released to inactive duty after World War II.
So when you were sent to your advanced training, such as the Fleet Sonar School, what was your daily routine there? What was a typical day?
Well, the daily routine was to go to classrooms and learn and have training on actual trainers that the Navy had designed at that time, where they could imitate or make you believe you were on a ship that was chasing a submarine. They had all that kind of electronic equipment developed, and that's how they trained operators of the equipment, and they trained people to interpret the activities that were taking place. And that was part of the training. The rest of it was actually at sea. They had a lot of small ships down there, sub chasers, and they had converted some large yachts, believe it or not, that had been owned by some of the wealthy people in the country. Navy had commandeered those, and they had converted them to training ships for sonar operations, and we would go out in the morning on these ships and spend the whole day out actually chasing submarines, chasing U.S. submarines that would operate with us.
That must have been interesting to train on a yacht.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty comfortable, I'll have to say that. Not exactly the same kind of environment you got on a destroyer, but they were nice ships, I'll have to agree.
So while you were still essentially in training, did you have any particularly memorable moments, like a particularly interesting liberty that you had taken or anything?
In my class in Key West was an admiral. And I've never, to this day, known what an admiral was doing in the class. He was monitoring the class, I think, for the Navy. And one day he said to me, "How would you like to take a bride? I said, what do you mean? He said, well, tomorrow or the next day or whatever it was, he said, I'm going to go down. They've invited me to come to Boca Chica Naval Air Station, and they're going to take me on a ride out over the Caribbean to see how the Naval Air Arm deals with submarine activities. I said, gee, that would be great. So he took me along on the flight. I can't even remember his name. And we went to Boca Chica Naval Air Station, got aboard PBY, which is a slow flying boat, and spent the entire day over the Caribbean at very low levels, working as trackers of submarines. They could track them from the air as well as from ships on the surface, and that was a rather interesting experience that I'll never forget.
Well, it gave you certainly a different perspective on the submarine warfare.
Yeah, it gave me an opportunity to see that that not only did the surface ships develop anti-submarine capability, but the naval air arm as well had provided a great deal, or would provide a great deal of help in those instances.
So what would you say was your best liberty?
My best liberty?
Sure.
In Key West, there isn't any such thing. I had several nice liberties in Miami, Florida, when I was there. The people who lived in that area were quite generous, as were the people, incidentally, in New York when I was in the shipping school. And many, many families offered opportunities for sailors such as we were to come spend a Sunday with them and have a nice meal at their home. Those were some of the memorable instances. Very friendly. People were very friendly toward the service at that time and had a lot of nice experiences that way. In Key West, there weren't very many opportunities to do things like that, and most of our time was spent bumming around the town, which was very small at that time, and maybe going out and getting a meal someplace that was different than what we were used to at the school.
So at that time, did you think that you were going to be assigned to the Atlantic, or did you think that you might be sent to the Pacific?
I had no idea, and I don't think anybody in the part of the service that I was in had that kind of opportunity. When you get assigned to a ship, you have to go where the ship goes.
Okay. So when did you discover that you were going to be sent to the Pacific?
Well, when we went to Norfolk, Virginia, and formed the crew for the ship, we knew that the ship would have to undergo, after we moved the crew aboard, we knew that we would have to undergo what they call shakedown in the Navy. In other words, test the ship out, see if it's going to hold up, and if something's going to break down, we wanted to break down then instead of later on. So after we had completed most of that shakedown, we, of course, were interested to know what we were going to do, and out of the blue came orders that we were to proceed through the Panama Canal and out to the Westpac, what they call Westpac at that time, and to try to arrive in time to participate in the Okinawa campaign.
That's incredible. So what did you think of the Evans when you saw her? How far along was she in her construction?
Well, the Evans was completed at that particular time. The Evans was launched in 1944, in October of 1944, and it was actually placed under command in the New York on the February the 3rd, 1945, and we were really just elated with the ship. It was a beautiful ship, brand new crew, and we thought, gee, we're getting the latest, and it was at that particular time the latest of the destroyers. It was a short hull Allen Sumner class destroyer. It had six 5-inch 38 dual-purpose guns, and it was loaded with anti-submarine warfare equipment, which, of course, at that time was a real concern. That's funny. The Navy developed a lot of anti-submarine warfare equipment when anti-submarine warfare was actually starting to die out. The submarine, the effect of the submarine in the Pacific was negative, almost negative, compared to what it had been in the Atlantic. But we're all elated at the fact that we had a brand new ship and we had a brand new crew, and we had a great skipper, one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. And the crew, I thought, was very highly organized, and it looked like we were going to be a real organization. Interesting fact, in going to the Pacific, they had us escort one of the Navy's two battle cruisers. Now, most people don't even know that there was such a thing as a battle cruiser, but at one time the Navy authorized the construction of three battle cruisers, which were very strange ships. They were about 600 feet long, and they were narrow. They're how we always called them. They said they were sharp as a knife because they appeared so long compared to their breadth. But we were at that time ordered to escort the CB-2, which was the USS Guam, out to Pearl Harbor. Well, the worst part about it was the Navy forgot to design the fuel tanks on the battlecruiser large enough to allow it to travel very far without having to refuel. So we left the Panama Canal with CB-2 with us, and we were escorting it, and the CB-2, because of its fuel capacity and no place to refuel between the Panama Canal and Pearl Harbor, we made the trip at 7 knots. It seemed like it took forever for us to get from the Panama Canal to Pearl Harbor. I don't know how many miles that is, but that's a lot of nautical miles. And it took many, many days for us to get there, but we eventually got the CB-2 to Pearl. The first CB-1 was called the Alaska, the USS Alaska. The second one, the one that we escorted, was the USS Guam. And the third one was supposed to be the USS Kentucky. USS Hawaii, I'm sorry. The Navy decided before the third one was even completed, after the hull had been laid in the shipyard, the Navy decided to cancel it as a battlecruiser, and they changed the ship from the hull up to an aircraft carrier.
So after you'd escorted the battlecruiser, you then proceeded westward to...
After we escorted the battlecruiser out to Hawaii, we said goodbye to them, and of course we were ordered to proceed on to Okinawa. We left Pearl Harbor. We went to the little island of Ulithi. We refueled there, went to the island of Guam, refueled there. The first one was Inuitok, where the nuclear tests were made many years later. Then to Guam, then to Ulithi, and then to the Okinawa campaign, to Okinawa itself.
And what was the Evans role at Okinawa?
At Okinawa, the Navy had established 9 picket stations, radar picket stations, around the island to try to be early warning stations, early warning facilities for Japanese suicide planes and bombers that were trying to approach the island, because the U.S. forces had landed on Okinawa and were trying to secure the island at that time. So all of our time was spent on radar picket stations. We were sent to different ones at different trips out, but there were a total of 9 stations, and you didn't know which one you were going to draw, so it was just up to your luck. On the picket station, we had 4 small craft with us, which we called small boys. They were small LCS type ships that had rocket launchers. And why they had them out there with rocket launchers, because there's nothing to launch a rocket at when you're 50 or 60 miles from Okinawa. But they were along anyhow. I think they were there to pick the destroyer sailors up out of the water after the kamikazes landed on the destroyers. The Navy lost 16 destroyers on those stations due to kamikaze action.
And you saw some of that kamikaze action, I'll wager.
On July 29th, 1945, which incidentally was my birthday, we had just come back in from RP, what we call RP9, Radar Picket Station 9. We spent 4 days out there. We had just come back into Okinawa. We had let the fires die out under our boilers, except for one boiler that we keep going. And we were going to have 4 days R&R, so to speak, in other words, in port, just to maintain the ship and get a little rest. And before the boilers had even gotten cool, we got an emergency message to get underway again and go relieve the ship, or go back out to the RP-9, that the USS Callahan, which had relieved us on station, had been taken under fire by, or not taken under fire, but had been struck by a kamikaze plane, and was in bad shape. So we had to re-establish fire in the boiler and get underway, and we went out there at 30-some knots as fast as we could, and got out there after midnight, and when we got there, the Callahan had sunk, and the sea was full of sailors from the Callahan trying to survive. Everything was oil all over everything. And we spent the rest of the night pulling some of those fellows aboard, as did some other ships that had been sent there to rescue them and bring them back in. Incidentally, the funny part about it was about 10 years later in my hometown, after I had gotten out of the service, I was in a supermarket. And I was talking to one of the guys that worked in the supermarket, and we got to tell him sea stories. And he told me, he said he'd been on the destroyer that had been sunk at Okinawa. And I said, what ship? And he said, well, it was a Callahan. And I said, that's amazing. I said, I was aboard the ship that helped rescue some of the people from the Callahan that night, and I think he was one that we had probably picked up. I'm not certain. But it was amazing. The Callahan was the 16th. And last destroyer sunk at Okinawa. A lot of damage done out there to the Navy ships. So many of the carriers were severely damaged by kamikaze planes. Some of them barely were able to make it back into port. But that was the way the Okinawa campaign was fought as far as the Navy was concerned. Oh, and incidentally, got to go ashore for R&R and on the little island of Aishima, which is on the west side of Okinawa. Aishima is just a little atoll that sticks up out of the ocean. But you know, you can't drink aboard a Navy ship. But we used to carry a little bit of beer along for the guys when we would get someplace where they could have some recreation. They'd usually all go ashore and play baseball and get their ration of 2 cans of beer. That's the island on which Ernie Pyle, the writer from Indiana that was killed, Aishima.
That's interesting. You know, you're from Indiana, and then you go to an island where another Indianan had been.
Had died. Yes, that's right.
So, during your time in the Pacific, you really did not have. I mean, in terms of your personal job, that is, in the anti-submarine warfare portion of the ship, you did not have much to do.
I didn't have much to do. I was made an assistant communication officer while aboard the ship, and because of the fact that they didn't want to see me loafing, I guess, not having anything to do, they put me in communication so that I could assist in some of the communications work. We had an awful lot of communications on a ship of that size. That would come in encoded in secret so that the enemy, of course, couldn't interpret it, and we'd have to break the messages. official business in the Navy.
Okay. So that was your average routine aboard the ship?
That's right.
So what other things did you do while you were aboard ship?
Well, while we were in Okinawa, after the Okinawa campaign ended and the island had been secured, there was quite a bit of escorting to do, and we did help escort. We worked with the task force, forces that were operating, I forget what they were, Task Force 57 and 77, I guess were the numbers. Anyhow, we would get assigned as plane guard. The carriers, when they normally are in launch or landing operations, they have destroyers operating in certain positions around them that are considered to be plane guard stations, where if a plane biffs the ship in trying to land or didn't make it off the ship when it was trying to take off, the carrier would be in a position to try assist in rescuing the pilot or the crew of the ship at that time. So every carrier operated with plane guard during landing and takeoff operations, landing and launching operations, I guess you'd say.
Okay. And so when you had some recreation time, what did you do during your off hours?
Well, there wasn't very many places to go. We did go into Buckner Bay at Okinawa and put the anchor down, so to speak, and swing around what we call swinging around the hook. Just the fact that we got to relax was about the only entertainment we had at that time. There was no place to go. They couldn't put us ashore there. And we were there with maybe 100 other ships that were doing the same thing. So it was just a matter of letting your hair down a little bit and relaxing and not have to worry about operations for a few days.
So do you have an opportunity to watch any movies while aboard ship?
All the time were available, and the Navy was very good about that. They passed the movies every time we'd go alongside a tanker, and we refueled a lot at sea. There was no place to refuel on shore in Okinawa, but we'd refuel at sea. The tankers, of course, would supply us with movies. That was an important part. Of course, we always got mail and movies from the tankers like that. And that was our main bit of entertainment aboard the ship. There was usually a movie every night if you wanted to go.
That's not bad to have a movie every night.
They had very good service, I have to say that, as far as movies were concerned. And amazingly so, they got some of the latest movies at that time available.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yes, sir.
Well, being resupplied while at sea must have been a very delicate operation.
Delicate operation, and you wouldn't believe how utterly dangerous it actually is. We used to refuel, too, from carriers. The carriers had quite a fuel supply, and we would refuel from a carrier on the starboard side because the island is on the starboard side of a carrier, on the right side. The captain of the carrier could look down and see us on the right side, whereas he couldn't see us if we were on the port side because the flight deck would be in his way. And the carriers oftentimes would have fuel lines over to us, and we would be refueling at a reasonable speed. And the carrier would get orders to launch or to do something, and we would have to turn along with the carrier with fuel lines over and pick up our speed at the same rate he did so that we could, until we could get disconnected, if you know what I mean.
That's
very
incredible.
Very precarious operation, but unbelievably effective.
Well, the helmsmen on both ships had to be very, very keen.
We always used the best we had.
So,
incidentally, at the same time we were refueling, it might be that they would be transferring sailors from the destroyer to the carrier if they were ill or if they had required surgery or something of that nature, because the carrier always had a larger hospital availability than the destroyer did. Well, all we had was a sick bay.
Oh, and what What kind of a position did you have?
Well, they sent them around a line, if you know what I mean. They put them in a harness, and they put a line over to the ship, and the trolley goes across, and they take them over on a line like that on a buoy. I forget what they call it, a breeches buoy, I guess. I don't know. It gets along.
So on board Evans or similar destroyers, what kind of physician did you have? Did you have a regular doctor, or did you have a foreman?
We had a doctor, Dr. J.H. Anigers. I can remember him well. He still lives out in the Pacific Northwest, and he could take care of most problems that we had, unless it was a surgical procedure such as appendix. If someone had to have an appendix removed, he couldn't do that because he didn't have facilities. But we would get alongside a carrier someplace and transfer the patient over so that it could be done at the carrier, or so we could get him ashore somehow to a hospital or someplace where it would have to be done. But he could take care of setting bones or things like that, where that was about the extent of it.
Well, you said that you remembered him well. Did you have any kind of experience with him that would cause you to remember
him? Well, let me tell you, Dr. Anigers' secondary job on the ship was the guy who surveyed all the outgoing mail back when you had to have your mail examined before, so he wouldn't be sending any secrets anywhere. And he was the guy who did the. I can see him sitting in the wardroom now at the end of the table, going through the mail. You put your wrote a letter, you put it in an envelope, you didn't seal it, and he went through the letter and made sure that there was nothing objectionable in the letter as far as the Navy was concerned, Navy activities, and the letter got sealed and sent off the ship. He was our guy that did that.
So what were your living conditions like aboard Evans?
Living conditions were pretty decent. I lived in the forward officer's quarters on the first deck below the main deck. Unfortunately, that was the part where the six ensigns lived that later went down with the forward part of the ship off of Vietnam. Those people in those quarters did not survive the crash or the accident at sea. But it was very comfortable. There was two of us to a room, and we had access to the main part of the ship by just going up one ladder. One internal inside ladder on the ship, and we were in the wardroom area, and that was pretty. We six of us down there. We had one shower, and like I said, there was two to a room. We had double deck bunks, and very very comfortable. Had a little lavatory in the room. Had a nice place to store your underwear and your clothing, and. Got along pretty good that way. Living quarters, living conditions on a destroyer at that time were not all that bad. Now, back in some of the cruise quarters, the bunks got to be, I think, three high, which meant that instead of just one above, two tiered, they were three tiered. But they were still comfortable. There was plenty of room. Not like it would be on a submarine.
Oh, no, which is much, much more cramped.
That's right.
Especially the submarines at that time.
Yeah.
So during your time aboard the Evans, what would you say was probably your most memorable experience?
Well, the most memorable experience probably was the night we had to go out when the Callahan was sunk. Probably the one that sticks with me most. Other than that, I don't think of any others that were really outstanding.
Now, I'm sure that having a living situation where you are in rather cramped conditions with several people for long stretches of time, that there must have been some times where someone did something particularly entertaining, or at least something humorous happened. Did you actually have any particularly memorable humorous experiences?
One night, and the officers, a lot of the, now, everybody aboard the ship played cards. one night in the wardroom, a group of the officers were sitting around the wardroom table, and they were playing poker. Now, they weren't playing poker with any money. They were just playing poker. And the captain, who was Harry Smith, and like I told you, a kindly gentleman, he was just as nice as you'd ever want to know. Captain Smith, at night, if he was called because of something happening at sea, like a contact or a ship or something, or possibility of getting involved with another ship that was ahead of us or around, the first thing he would do would, his quarters were immediately forward of the CIC, and Captain Smith wore pajamas every night. And if he was called, he picked up his cap, his commander's cap, put it on, walked back out of his quarters into the CIC, where he could see the overall picture without having to go clear up to the bridge. He could find out exactly what was going on. But Captain Smith was that kind of a guy. And the night that the guys were around the wardroom table playing poker, Captain Smith was just walking around the deck. It was late at night, and he was in his pajamas, and he had his cap on, and he looked in one of the portholes that you could see into the wardroom. He saw the guys playing poker, and he knew poker from any other card game. He could tell. He walked in, and he said, "Gentlemen, don't let me ever see this again," and turned around and walked out. And I want to tell you, he never saw it again. That's all he had to say. He was a very understanding person, but everybody aboard the ship knew Captain Smith meant business when he said something. He was very fond, believe it or not, of Avocet. Now, Avocet was something like canned milk. And if we had, in the morning, we had something like oatmeal, prepared cooked cereal of some sort, Captain Smith always liked to have Avocet on his cooked cereal. And the supply officer, Jack Wassmer, always made sure when he went in to resupply the ship when we were in port, he always made sure that he got a couple of cases of Avocet for Captain Smith.
Well, you have to keep the captain happy.
That's right. And he was a great one. I tell you, I couldn't have had a nicer commanding officer. And I can't say that for all of them. Some of them were very inept, really, what I would consider inept. But he was a very bright man. He had a lot of experience prior to coming to taking command of the Evans. And he knew the sailing business real well. Very good.
Well, since you were on the ship before shakedown and during shakedown and from there on, shakedown, everyone is getting accustomed to a new ship. Were there any particularly humorous experiences during your shakedown cruise?
Well, no, I don't know of any particular humorous ones. We did have some breakdowns of some of the equipment. You know, during shakedown, they take the ship out at sea, and they actually, you have a required full speed run for an hour or something like that, where they actually crank this ship up to its highest speed, and all kinds of readings are made to make sure that the propulsion system is operating at its best. And under those conditions, we might have had some humorous things, but I'm not aware of any. I remember we used to have an old chief commissary steward on the ship. I don't even remember his name. He used to love to fish. And any time the ship was in port, even during shakedown, when we get to go in, like into Guantanamo Bay or something at night, he'd be on the fantail of the ship fishing. And at sea, since he was the chief commissary steward on the ship, he had access to all kinds of leftover foods and things of that nature. And I've seen him go back with a piece of a piece of meat that was no longer usable and put it on a big hook and drag it behind the ship. Sometimes even while the ship was underway, he loved to fish for sharks. And he would get a shark occasionally now and then, and I don't know how he did it, but somehow he would strip the shark, and whatever kind of fish he would get, I don't know, had a backbone to it, a spine, and get down to the place where he ended up with a spine of a fish that he would make into a walking stick.
Now, he'd
been in the Navy too long.
That is really unusual.
Yes, it sure is.
Well, I understand that you have you had an experience with the ship's whistle.
When the ship was in commission, or we got underway for the first time after the commissioning. We were at a pier in Brooklyn, New York, and there were four brand new destroyers, all one destroyer division. And it so happened that Captain Harry Smith, my skipper, was the senior captain. Well, in the way things go in the Navy, the guy that's the most senior, he gets to do things first. We had a ship outboard of us, if you know what I mean. We were alongside a pier, and on the starboard right side, we were up to against the pier. On the left side was another destroyer, just like ours, tied to us. And because Captain was the senior guy, they had to spring the other ship out away. I forget what they called doing that, but anyhow, they released the lines long enough that we can slip out from the ship, between the ship and the shore or the pier, and we were ready to get underway. And Captain Smith was going to lead us out. We were going to go down for our shakedown down to Guantanamo, and I was, at that particular time, as anti-submarine officer, I would have absolutely nothing to do as far as sonar was concerned, so I was made the junior officer of the deck. And the junior officer of the deck, all he did was take orders from the senior officer of the deck. So we were on the bridge getting underway condition. And the captain was standing up on top of the pilot house in his splendor, and he was a very nice-looking man, very stately. And he was standing there so that he could see behind us and around us before we backed out into the East River. And when we were ready to go, and he said, started the engines in reverse so that we could slowly start to back out, the procedure is to give one prolonged blast on the whistle so that the people coming up and downstream know that there's a ship backing out. Well, when we got ready to go, Captain Smith said to Lieutenant Young, the officer of the deck, sound one prolonged blast. And Lieutenant Young said to Ensign Druckenmiller, sound one prolonged blast. On the front of the pilot house was a big lever. And you pull down on that lever, and that sounded the whistle. The whistle was a steam whistle attached to the number one stack on the ship, the front of it. And when I pulled down on the lever to sound the one prolonged blast, a column of water came out of that whistle. It was about 4 inches in diameter, and hit the captain right in the face. And his cap flew off and everything else. I can to this day hear him say, hey, what's going on? It seems as though the diaphragm in the whistle had failed and allowed enough steam to leak up through the whistle, which had condensed, and the whistle actually contained a column of cold water at that time, which is the blast that the captain got in the face. Fortunately, I didn't get blamed for it. It was one of those things that you experience on shakedown that has to be fixed.
So when you were at sea, and whenever you pulled into various ports, did you ever visit Suriga Bay?
Who's that?
Did you ever?
Suriga Bay.
Okay.
Yeah, we were sent to. We had an opportunity to spend a couple, 3 days. They drew straws, sent some of us ashore to little R&R, Suriga Bay, I think you called it, and we were down there for a while just to plenty to drink and plenty to eat, nice food, and all prepared by the Japanese. and we enjoyed ourselves there. I'd say that's the only R&R type thing that I really had an opportunity to take while serving the ship.
Who ran the facility?
The facility was run by the Army.
That must have been interesting to have the Army serve the Navy.
Well, the Army used Japanese people to serve the Navy. They didn't do it themselves, but that's exactly the case. The Army did have control of all those facilities.
Okay. And you had mentioned that you on your way towards Okinawa that you had stopped off in Guam. Were there any facilities there?
At Guam, we stopped at Apra Harbor, and they had thousands and thousands of people going in and out of Guam at that time, Army, Navy, and all. And the only facilities that we had at that time to enjoy was to get off the ship for a brief time and go ashore, and they had a big Quonset hut, a huge Quonset hut, and they served beer. And the guys all wanted to go in there and get a can of beer. The only trouble was they didn't have any ice to cool the beer, so it was all hot beer. And the building, of course, was about 120 degrees inside, and the beer was about the same temperature. That was the extent of it. Guam was very warm.
Well, you would think that with so much beer, it would have been a popular place.
Yes, right.
Well, that must have been an interesting experience to have beer that warm.
It was not very good, but they had it available. It seemed that now and then that can of beer was important to a lot of people. I don't know. I'm not that much of a beer drinker myself, but I know back in those days it was more or less the change, something different to do.
It's a break from routine at the very least.
Break from the routine, exactly.
So while you were at sea, did you write to friends and family very often?
As often as I could, yes. We had a lot of time to do things like that, and the only problem was we never knew when we wrote the letter when it was going to get off the ship, because you had to be certain places, like I say, alongside a carrier or a tanker or someplace where you could transfer mail, where you knew that it was going to be moving back toward home.
And did your friends or family write letters to you very often?
Got a lot of letters from home.
Okay.
Usually all in bunches.
So was it mostly your family who wrote to you?
My family, yes, and friends. A few friends that I had I had acquired over the years. I had some letters to them. Most of it was family activity.
So you got a lot of news from home.
Got all the news from home that I could handle.
So it was almost like having newspaper delivery.
That's exactly. Now, we did have capability. We had magazines that were subscribed to, I don't know, by the Navy or somebody, that would come in with the mail that people got to look at. But no newspapers as such. We printed our own little newspaper on the ship. You know, the communications department had the capability of picking up a news broadcast or news-type programs. And in those days, the guys had to set copy that news by listening to dots and dashes. They don't anymore. It goes through like facsimile and email and every other thing. But the guys would in the radio shack would prepare a newsletter, usually each day, that would tell us what was going on, most of the important happenings.
Well, since you worked in the communications department for most of your time aboard Evans, did you ever have an opportunity to listen to Tokyo Rose or anything similar?
I never heard Tokyo Rose, although some of those people did out there. They had late at night, particularly when there was not much traffic being exchanged, the radio operators had the freedom to tune around and listen to things like that. They probably heard things like that. I never did.
Oh, okay. So during your time aboard Evans, or at least during your time in service, What sorts of awards or citations or commendations did you receive?
Well, I got about 8 or 10 area campaign medals. See, I acquired some of those during my trip on the Evans, and then I acquired a few more when I was recalled in 1950. See, I spent another 2 years back in the service having been recalled in 1950, and I went back to another ship that was almost identical to the Evans and spent the greater part of 2 years aboard that ship. Well, aboard two ships, that one and another one. Later on, I spent 4 months aboard it. So I acquired campaign medals. I did not acquire any major medals of any kind other than the Korean Presidential Unit Citation, and everybody got that so during Korea, so that was the extent of it.
Okay. And so what did you think, or what do you think in about your experiences now when you look back on your time aboard the Frankie Evans?
Well, my experience was a good one. I knock on wood occasionally that I didn't get hurt, and nobody on the ships that I served in lost their life. I was fortunate when we had some accidents, but nobody was seriously injured, and it was an experience that naturally, I'll never forget. I appreciated what the Navy provided for me during that time so much that I spent a total now of 26 and a half years in the Naval Reserve. After I left the service after Korea, even I continued on in the Naval Reserve, and for a number of years I represented the Naval Academy in this area of northeastern Indiana, southern Michigan, and northwestern Ohio as what they called a blue and gold officer. I was available to consult with young men who were interested in knowing how to get in the Naval Academy. And I did that for a period of years before my total retirement from the service, which took place in 1970.
So, wow, you remained very active in the Navy.
I remained active in the reserve program pretty much so, yes. I made, when I lived in Marion, as I told you, I made many, many trips back and forth between Marion and Muncie where there was a Naval Reserve Training Center. Now the School of Architecture for Ball State University.
So, during your time aboard Evans, did you collect any souvenirs?
Oh, I got some souvenirs. I've got a Japanese rifle. I got a Japanese parachute flare flag. Not the flag, parachute. A flare parachute. A silk parachute that is used to drop one of those things that makes a lot of light. I forget what you call them. It wasn't an incendiary, but it was a like a phosphorus type material that they would use. So they could fire it up in the air, and it would come down slowly, and it would provide a tremendous amount of light.
Well, like a starburst.
Starburst, yeah, similar to that. This was the silk parachute that would be used to cause that to float down slowly. I've got one of those.
Oh, how did you come by these?
Well, I came by them and. At the end of the service, they sent us up in the northern part of the Sea of Japan to try to see if we could, try to rescue Jonathan Wainwright. And we were up in that area and got a chance to go ashore up in that area to see what was going on. And that was the extent of it. I picked up a few fragments at that point in time, a few little memorabilia, pieces of memorabilia.
Do you have any other comments about either your time in the service or your time aboard Frankie Evans?
I had a rather interesting trip to the west side of Korea at the end of the war. They sent us up to I got to be careful. I get I'm mixing in my mind. even with my friends that I developed in both of those places. But had an interesting trip up to a little town on Ongjin on the west coast of Korea, where we had heard that the Japanese had stored a lot of bombs and things of that type to use against the U.S. Navy if we attacked the mainland. Well, we never got that far, of course, because the atomic bomb stopped it from being there. But we were sent up there with a Japanese minesweeper, and these guys were sent ashore to destroy. They were experts in ordnance and destroying, in ordnance work, and they were there to destroy the ordnance that had been stored up there so that it would no longer be hazardous to the people. And I got to go on that trip. We were inland about 4 or 5 days in this little town, just short ways inland, where we established a kind of a camp and a cabin that was there. And these Japanese people took these bombs and things and brought them out of the caves and put them in a big hole out in the middle that had been established. They would explode them to destroy them. So that was kind of an unusual experience. But that happened anyhow.
Wow. So when did you first hear about the collision between Evans and Melbourne?
Well, after I left the service, I was a member. I had kept in pretty close contact with most of my friends, people that I knew had served at the same time I did, and of course they started some newsletters going around that told us about interesting things that may have happened, and I think I learned about the collision through something like that, or either and the newspaper articles that I saw that where they reported the collision.
And what were your first thoughts?
Well, I was really disturbed because I thought, well, that's an unfortunate circumstance, and there's a nice ship that gotten the worst of it, and the bad part about it was at that particular time they weren't quite sure about the loss of life, but it became to be substantial, and that was the sad part about the whole thing.
And you've maintained close contact with your shipmates still.
I've maintained close contact with many of my shipmates for 50 years. Still to this day. I just got a message just yesterday on email that one of the officers that I associated with on the ship, his name was Fine, Jerome Fine. He was the assistant communication officer, and he lived in New Jersey, that he had passed away.
Yes, I learned about that yesterday.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Yes. Jerry was a nice guy, and we had to laugh about him. He was perpetually seasick. That was the worst part about it. But he was a nice guy, and I've kept in contact with him ever since we got out of the service.
Now, someone tells me, it may have been you, that Mr. Fine had, let's just say, a crush on June Allison.
What, me?
Well, someone told me that he often would refer to her as his girlfriend, and that he had pictures of her.
That sounds like something Eldon Keeler would have told you.
Well, it's most unfortunate that he passed.
Yes. It was a sudden thing. The message I got indicated that he had a brain aneurysm or something of that nature, which was rather quick.
That's my understanding from the family, yes.
Right.
Well, I thank you very much for your time, Mr. Druckmiller, and we hope to see you again soon.
Well, thank you. You know, I was going to ask you one little thing here. Now, the fellow that I met at the convention, or the reunion, not the convention, the reunion, his name was Frankum.
Yes, Ron Frankum.
Now, is he still associated with this study?
No, he has departed the archive.
I see. Okay. I kind of wondered, since your name became a new one for me, I didn't know what had happened to him. Well, that's fine.
Oh, well, we're sad to see him go.
Well, I just want you to take care of my buddy Bobby Knight. I graduated from Purdue, and he was the coach at Indiana. And of course, we had nothing but a battle up here all the time he was there.
Well, he's behaved himself very well here.
Well, that's good, because I tell you what, if he can do a lot for a university, he has a name following that's pretty good.